Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FoxBet. College football week 8. Time flies when you're having fun in the college football ranks. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider.
Surprised you got that much pep in your step this early in the morning, especially after a Yankees loss.
I'm trying to come out firing more so than Aaron Boone in the lineup he continues to put out there for the Yankees, burying our man Gleyber Torres deep into the depths of hitting fifth in that offensively challenged lineup.
Yep.
I don't know what to say.
I mean, he kind of screwed the pooch in game two with some of the pitching changes, and then he drops Gleyber from third to fifth like a lunatic. And the decision is immediately horrific. You get the first inning, and you got guys on first and second with no outs, and up come two guys past their prime who pop up in the infield and came in, move a runner over, and then Gleyber comes up fifth. He doesn't see a pitch within 3 feet of the plate. And then in the second inning, you got two on, two out with Judge up. And because he's got Brent Gardner protecting him, he doesn't see a hittable pitch. So I think the initial stage of that game is a little different if Gleyber's batting third. I really do.
Well, either way, the Yankees have put up more of a fight against the Astros in the future we held on the St. Louis Cardinals, which can officially be put to bed. So either way, that's a minute of baseball talk. There you go, right off the top of the show. But college football, the main topic of discussion. Let's thank the USC Trojans for an excellent second half last weekend against Notre Dame to allow us to cash another best bet in the college football ranks. You have any thoughts on what you saw last weekend at all, Payne, or want to get right into the games?
Let's just get right into it.
All right, let's do it.
Make it happen.
All right, let's start.
Give them the goods.
Let's start today's show in Seattle, where the Washington Huskies will welcome in the Oregon Ducks. Washington finds themselves 3-point home underdogs. Total on this game sits at 50 and a half thereabouts at FoxBet. And I guess, Payne, the biggest question in this game, and we'll get to the Oregon offense in a second, is how good is this Oregon defense as far as some of the metrics? We know what they haven't allowed as far as points per game, holding Colorado, Cal, Stanford, Montana, Nevada to one total touchdown. But is there a fly in the ointment? Can Washington exploit what we've seen from the Ducks on the defensive side of the ball?
I think the Oregon defense is really good. And I knew they always had the talent. And then when you bring in an elite pass rusher, a five-star guy on the defensive line, now you have NFL talent on all three levels. And so I think they're fantastic on that side of the ball. The secondary, I don't know if they've really been challenged quite yet. And we'll see if Jacob Eason can present that challenge, because it's a huge game for him, right? This is a game where NFL evaluators will be there. This is the piece of tape I think scouts will look at most, because you see Oregon, and right now across the board, schedule adjusted, everything incorporated, Oregon's defense is number one in overall efficiency. And so it's the biggest test for Eason so far. It's what people are going to use to gauge him and whatever he is, the new improved self. When you start to look at Washington's offense and who they've played so far and the two losses they've had, they've come against the two best defenses they faced, right? Jacob Eason against Cal wasn't very good, wasn't great against Stanford either. And Stanford's defense, Todd, I think we don't really believe they're that great, but that's the second best defense efficiency-wise that Eason's faced. And so when you look at Eason in those two specific games, I think it was struggle city for him. And what was really concerning to me was how he threw on downs that weren't predictable. So, you know, I know there was a weather delay in the Cal game. It was about 3 hours. But you look at home, Eason completes 53% of his passes for 3.5 yards per attempt on standard downs, right? That has to improve here when you're talking about a down where defenses don't know whether it's run or pass. Same situation in the Stanford game. Eason was 8 for 21 on standard down passing. So, got to be better on those early down throws. I think they need to find, and when I say they, Washington needs to find ways to manufacture yards and efficiency on the ground. I think you're going to probably need to help Eason out. The Huskies' offensive line, to me, has been really good. They've created some push in the ground game and some running lanes. They're 10th in rushing success rate. So I think that's probably the one area, when you look at Oregon's defense, that hasn't shown yet to be elite. They're 32nd in rushing success rate allowed. The other important thing here for the Washington offense is when Eason does drop back to throw, the Washington O-line needs to continue to kind of be, Fort Knox. They've only allowed him to be pressured on 22% of his dropbacks, right? But when Eason has been pressured, 41 passer rating when the heat is on. So he has been erratic at best with pressure, and I'm trying to put that nicely for a kid who's not getting paid. at least this go round, at least.
That's Jared Goff type efficiency when he's under duress.
Yes. So, bottom line, I think Washington has to be able to have some success on the ground here. We need to see Eason execute better when situations are in his favor, throwing it on first down or second down again, when it's not predictable. And Washington's O-line needs to kind of keep Eason clean. So those are the three things I think that need to happen for Washington's offense to move it efficiently here.
I mean, we have seen the Huskies find some success running the football, 187 yards or more in 4 out of their last 5. Ahmed and McGrew have done a decent job there, but you're exactly right. I mean, you look at this Washington receiving core, or lack thereof. I mean, you essentially have two weapons that Oregon really has to game plan for, Aaron Fuller and Hunter Bryant. And oftentimes you watch Washington and forget that Hunter Bryant is even out there and so highly regarded by scouts at the next level, because they tend to ignore him for extended stretches. On the other side of the ball, Oregon has a pro prospect, a quarterback of their own, as we obviously know, in Justin Herbert, who has underwhelmed at least me when I watch this Oregon offense. But for the first time, maybe all season, they showed some balance against an inferior defense in Colorado. I mean, running the ball for 252 yards, throwing for 275, but a major injury for the Oregon Ducks. You lose tight end Jacob Breland out for the season. His 26 catches, 405 yards, and 6 touchdowns led the team across the board. And the one thing, Payne, watching that game Friday night against the Buffs, they really didn't attack the middle of the field once Breland went out with that injury.
You're spot on, And I'm not really sure what we're going to get from either of these units in this matchup. And to me, both have regressed year over year. I know you watch these games closer than I do. You watch more college football than I do. But just metrically speaking, both units have regressed. And I think based on our expectation coming into the season, they've been disappointing relative to that expectation. Everyone knows that I've been uber critical of Marcus Arroyo and his conservative approach, especially on early downs. And it's not just like the last few weeks, but for multiple seasons now, I've said this. And so, when you have a top 10 pick at quarterback in an all-world offensive line, and I think some would say potentially the best offensive line in college football, Marcus Arroyo's offense, to your point, 49th in overall efficiency. We didn't expect that at all. You mentioned Justin Herbert's go-to guy through there, Jake Breland, out for the season. And the thing about him is, and why he's so tough of a matchup, because he's that hybrid tight end receiver, extremely versatile, right? He's too fast for linebackers, too big for corners. When they were shredded with injury at wide receiver, they were kind of putting him out wide. So to me, when I kind of look at this matchup, it comes down to which unit plays like the version we projected them to be. And so when you look at Washington's defense, they were fourth last year. They've declined to 33rd. Right now in overall efficiency. You look at their style. It's always been that bend but don't break, the 4-2-5, try to keep everything in front. Don't get beat by the big explosive play. And unfortunately, that defense is not only bent at times, but they've even broken. And so you look at Washington, 83rd in success rate allowed defensively, 77th in explosive play defense. Justin Herbert in that offense, I think you kind of hit on this a little bit or hinted at it, they're kind of safe with the football. He's really accurate. His adjusted completion percentage is nearly 80%. That's 10th best in the country. So Herbert's going to take what you give him. And Oregon doesn't have a problem like methodically moving it down the field, which is what Washington's defense forced you to do, right? Like Chris Peterson and company doesn't believe 18, 19, 20-year-old kids can go on these 10, 11, 12, 14-play drives without making a mistake. That's basically the gist of his defense. That's the DNA of what he wants to do. So, in knowing that, I think there's two keys, right? And it's how does Oregon do on first down? Because that's one spot where Washington's really struggled, their first down defense. The Huskies are 91st in the country on first down success rate allowed. And I think it's partly because they haven't been able to stop the run. They have issues there. So I think that's also the second thing to watch for, the ground game, right? Washington's defense, 46% success rate allowed on runs. That's outside the top 100 in college football. So that's wild to me. And I mentioned the Ducks O-line is great. They typically dominate the trenches. And, there's been some, I think, issues with who's going to be the lead back there. There hasn't been that guy to like totally emerge. I think, C.J. Verdell did pretty good last week. He's starting to kind of take charge and he's coming into form a little bit against the Buffs defense. 58% of his 171 yards came after contact on Friday night. So I think if you're watching this at home, right, keep your eyes on first down. Can Oregon gain 5 or more yards to record that successful play? And then don't be a ball watcher. See if Oregon's offensive line is blowing the Huskies' D-line off the ball. So I think those are the two key things here to monitor for this matchup.
When you look at some of the most recent notes in this particular series, Oregon, 9 of their last 11 games away from Autzen have resulted in the under being able to get you to the window. 5-1 to the under this season. And the last 8 games played in this particular rivalry in Seattle, 6-2 to the under. Last thing on this campaign, when you look at the actual number itself here with Oregon, a roughly, we'll call it what they are, a field goal road favorite. What does that tell you and what have you seen?
So number's a little high. That's kind of what I've seen. And again, if you listen to the preview podcast all the way back in August, you kind of know our feelings on the Oregon coaching staff. You know our feelings on their performance away from home. It hasn't been good at all. They are a different team on the highway. And this is one of the toughest environments, I think, in college football. So you're looking at, even for a conference opponent, 5.5 is a home field advantage. You probably only make Oregon about 3.5, 4-point neutral favorite here. So there's some value on Washington, that's for sure.
And you know what? We'll keep things in Pac-12 country because one game in the Pac-12 for your favorite Conference of Champions isn't enough.
Yeah, so we're going to the. I don't know how we did that. We had an option here for our listeners at home. We had an option. It was going to be Wake Forest FSU or USC Arizona, and so. The man I am, the man of the people. I said, they don't want to hear about Florida State, do they? Let's give them USC. And that'll probably make them feel warm and tingly after winning us money last week. So that's just kind of the guy I am.
I mean, if USC hadn't covered, there's no way we would have been talking about the USC Trojans in back-to-back weeks. Let's call a spade here and be completely honest with our true assessment and how we elect to go about it. But since they did, they'll play host to the Arizona Wildcats, and it's USC a 9.5-point favorite. Total in this game is 67 at Foxbet. And when we look at Arizona, I guess paying the $100 million question every single week you handicap the Wildcats, what are we going to get out of Khalil Tate? Has only shown flashes of the dual threat quarterback that we've grown accustomed to when he burst onto the scene, and many people called him a dark horse Heisman candidate, but of late hasn't been able to get things going. But what's crazy about this Arizona offense, they're amongst one of the best teams in the country when it comes to explosive play potential.
So I was looking at a bunch of metrics for Khalil Tate. I got to tell you, they look better than what my eyes see. And I think that's probably the same for you, right? So, you look at a lot of these sites out there, and they've graded Khalil Tate as one of the 10th best quarterbacks, one of the 10 best quarterbacks in the country this year so far, which was interesting to see. I would, again, I'm all about metrics. But my eyes don't tell me that, and I can tell you his head coach doesn't believe that to be true, right? Got the yank last week. But to your point, any and every defense that goes against this version of Arizona with Khalil Tate running the show, their first job has to be removing his legs from the game, right? Force Khalil Tate to be a passer from the pocket. I think we're aware of some of his, you know, deficiencies with accuracy. We've also seen Tate have a tendency to hold the ball too long. He runs out of clean pockets at time and puts himself into pressure's way. He runs himself into sacks. So all in all, you know, if Tate beats you with his mind and his arm from inside the pocket, I think you tip your cap. He did it against Colorado. Couldn't do it against a stiffer defense in Washington. And so because of that, and again, I've kind of mentioned this a minute ago, Sumlin has kind of hinted that Grant Gunnell could see more reps and that he's not worried about burning his red shirt because last week was the third game he played in, and he came out immediately when reporters asked, said, hey, our plan wasn't to redshirt Gunnell. And Gunnell is Sumlin's guy. Khalil Tate is a leftover. So let's see how this plays out as the, you know, the season kind of progresses. Metrically speaking, though, I think Arizona can have some success on the ground, even with the Trojans focused on that, if Khalil Tate's healthy, right? If you remove sack yardage from the equation for both units, and that's what you should do when you're gauging running, sacks allowed by Arizona removed, sacks for USC, remove that. Arizona's offense is 17th in the country, averaging like nearly 6 yards per rush. USC's defense, 109th in the country. They allow over 5.5 yards per carry. So we've kind of talked about this, and we did so last week. The Trojan defense has talent, right? But they're young. They're wildly inconsistent. They lose some of their gap integrity pretty frequently, right? And if you're not going to be sound in your assignment, you know, you better make some negative plays and create some havoc. And right now, the Trojans are 104th in the country and stuff rate. So they're not stopping a lot of runs at or behind the line of scrimmage. The other factor that I think is not only going to impact the matchup on this side of the ball, but probably the game, when Arizona does get into the red zone, can they stay hot, right? Can they convert those trips into touchdowns? We know teams that run the ball are a little better in converting in the red zone, but, you know, season over season, when you look at those things, the red zone stuff, there's not just a large enough sample size, so it skews a lot season to season. But the Wildcats right now are 16th in the country, 74% touchdown success rate when inside the 20. USC's defense, also very good, 8th in the country, limiting opponents to a 40% touchdown clip. So whoever kind of wins that battle, you know, a couple 4-point swings probably is going to likely determine the winner here, Todd.
When you look at this Arizona offense, and we'll get to the other side of ball in a second, I was blown away, Payne, when I realized that Arizona leads the conference in third down conversion percentage at a shade less than 50. They're second in the Pac-12 with 103 plays of at least 10 yards, second in plays of at least 20 yards, first in plays of at least 30 yards, first in plays of at least 40 yards, and also lead in plays of 50, 60, and 70 yards. So They have that big play potential. I know a lot of that stuff has come against an inferior schedule early on, but you saw that, as you mentioned, in the game against Colorado, where they hit a couple of big plays and were able to change momentum. On the other side of the ball, I think obviously this is where the concerns have to start if you're Arizona. I mean, this is a team ranked 11th in the Pac-12 and 128th in the nation in pass defense, giving up more than 320 yards per game. And when you talk about pass rush, well, you may as well not include Arizona in the discussion because they really don't have one. 5 total sacks in 6 games doesn't bode very well for a high-flying USC passing attack, who we saw with Keaton Slovis, and we know their NFL-caliber wide receivers should have some success if he's throwing from a clean pocket.
Yeah, totally agree. And I, you know, not to be biased, I think USC probably should have won last week on the road in a hostile environment. They outgained Notre Dame on a yards-per-play basis, and we texted back and forth there probably after the end of the first quarter. Right. And we're like, man, this could come back to haunt them, not capitalizing early in this game, because the first 5 possessions for USC, they ended on the Notre Dame 43, the 50, the Notre Dame 22, the Notre Dame 42, and the Notre Dame 42 again. So, and all they had to show for those 5 drives was 3 points. So that was a little scary to me as we were watching that unfold early. Notre Dame kind of took advantage of those similar opportunities, and they weren't even really in great starting field position for you know, a couple of those opportunities in the second quarter where they extended that lead. But even though we were on USC plus 11, the one thing we had to overcome, and we specifically mentioned it last week when we gave it out, right, was overcoming some early rust from Keaton Slovis. But once Slovis kind of shook off the rust, Notre Dame couldn't stop him. Couldn't stop the USC offense. In the second half, USC had a 67% success rate in the third quarter, improved even more in the fourth quarter to 72%. So to me, you know, tip of the cap to Keaton Slovis. That's his second true road start as a true freshman, returning from a pretty nasty concussion. And I think it becomes even more impressive when you listen to Graham Harrell on Monday say, Notre Dame defensively did not do one thing in that game that they had put on film at any point in that season. So now you get Slovis, right? He's back home. It's an Arizona defense, which you kind of hinted at isn't very good, and they're not, right? They're outside the top 100 in overall efficiency, passing success rate allowed, and rushing success rate allowed. I think there's some reasons for that, right? You look at Arizona, they've played five top 50 offenses in terms of overall efficiency. Those five offenses have an average efficiency rank of 30th. So they're bad, but they've played some tough competition. I don't think they're good, but they, you know, potentially could improve here a little bit. But the one thing here is it seems to me Slovis is going to face like a similar style of defense, right? Arizona is bend but don't break. And we did see some blitzing from Notre Dame last week, but how they chose to play again, which was differently than they had shown on film all season. At times, Todd, like Notre Dame had like six guys and even only five guys in the box. And so, you know, I think every defense comes in with a game plan, right? Limit the Trojan receivers, limit their big playability. And if you look metrically, like I think that's why USC is only 81st in explosive passing. It's because you get only, you know, six guys in the box, maybe seven, and then you get, you know, four and five in coverage. The one thing that I really like about Slovis is he's shown an ability to kind of take what defenses give him, right? And that's really what Graham Harrell's offense is about. Be efficient down to down. It's why USC right now 15th in overall offensive success rate. 50% of their passes have graded successful. And think about this, Todd, right? Three different quarterbacks. So that number to me is really a byproduct of Graham Harrell's system. I love everything about Graham Harrell. I'm not ready to like anoint him like the next dude offensively, but he's coming pretty close. And with Arizona style defensively, right? Like Harrell showed last week as well, he doesn't have a problem handing it off if he's got those matchup advantages in the box. And I think when you think Graham Harrell, you're like, oh my God, he was Mike Leach's quarterback. And that's the mindset that he has, right? Playing under him at Texas Tech. And it's true. That's kind of how his offense is based, but he has always raved about his running backs and that he's got no issues having like Slovis turn around and hand it off to Stepp and Carr. And I know right now that depth is an issue, right? Because I think Vave is out. He needed his knee cleaned up. But to me, Carr is a good home run threat. And we saw last week, Marquise Stepp is going to be like a really good one. And if you've been listening to Graham Harrell the last few weeks, he's kind of been hinting like at this increased role in trying to find more ways to get Stepp involved in the offense. And he actually led the team in carries last week at Notre Dame. He backed it up, 70% success rate on the ground. So I think the door is open for more touches for him, which I think is a positive for the USC offense. And here's one thing that's pretty interesting, just stylistically. Clay Helton's always had a pretty good game plan against Arizona. Three games that he's faced Arizona, USC's gone for 250 yards or more on the ground. I think that's likely a big part of the game plan here again this week, Todd.
Well, you talk about Stepp. I mean, he was the workhorse that kept Notre Dame's defense honest and ultimately led to that rally in the second half that gave them more balance as he picked up some powerful, hard-to-churn-out yards because Notre Dame wasn't playing, you know, eight men in the box to try and take away USC's ground game. They were pretty open and honest, said, hey, look, we're not going to let the receivers beat us, much like USC was able to do against Utah, and the Irish ultimately successful with that game plan in terms of winning outright. Not obviously as it pertained to covering the closing number. Head to the SEC, Payne, for an early morning kickoff, 12 Eastern in Columbia. Two teams with very different results last weekend. And we see Florida, a 5.5-point road favorite going to William-Brice Stadium to take on the Gamecocks. Total in this game sits at 48 at Foxbet. And we try and assess these two teams and how they'll handle prosperity in the case of South Carolina, fresh off that outright upset of Georgia, a game that saw massive professional money come in on the Gamecocks from 24 down to 21, versus Florida, whose defense was exposed to a large extent against LSU's high-powered offense, but the Gators defensively dealing with some major injury concerns, and that was on full display against LSU because they weren't able to get pressure on the quarterback.
So, you know, to your question there, to your point about which team kind of steps up, you know, it's tough, I think, to gauge the mental makeup of these kids, right? And I think there's some factors potentially going in each direction. There could be this fatigue factor for Florida. You know, this is like a murderer's row schedule here. You're coming off the Auburn and LSU games. You're going back out on the road against South Carolina before the rivalry game against Georgia. And then you have Muschamp that would love nothing more than to kind of settle a personal score here against Florida. But, you know, my mind says that South Carolina beating Georgia might actually keep Florida on their toes a little more than what would have been the case, you know. I think Florida still has all their goals in front of them. They can still win the East. They can still win the SEC. Now, I have to be honest, when I was looking at what South Carolina did last week, we knew there was sharp money that took the 24.5. I believe it would have closed 21.
21. I don't think I ever saw a dip below the 3 touchdowns.
Yeah, I don't think so either. But I didn't really upgrade South Carolina much off that, right? Mostly it's because we were higher on the Gamecocks than the rest of the market, and we have been for pretty much the better part of the season because we thought they were going to be good, but the schedule was just so tough. Plus, I think Georgia kind of beat Georgia more than South Carolina did. And to your point here about this matchup, South Carolina's offense, they manufactured less than 4.4 yards per play last week. They were held 7% below the national average in overall offensive success rate last week. They were held below the national average in explosiveness as well, right? But they did win the turnover battle, and 4 turnovers from Georgia is, I guess, what did them in. So when you look at the South Carolina offense, I think it's important to note, right, Ryan Helinski was back at practice Tuesday in a really limited role. He had a knee brace on to kind of help deal with that sprain. I would envision, right, they've already come out and said he's played, so I would envision it's probably a shot pregame. If you remember, we talked about this last week with Kyle Trask. He had the same injury against Auburn. I think the difference was Trask returned in that game. Helinski didn't against Georgia. So whether it's Helinski having a little bit more severe knee sprain or maybe it was a pain tolerance thing, who knows? But I think South Carolina's offense is going to have to find ways to manufacture some yards here. They're going to have to get the ground game going. To their credit, they've faced 3 top 15 defenses. And despite that, South Carolina's 7th in the country in yards per rush, 5.8. 48% of runs have graded successful. That's 28th in the country. So for me, bottom line, I think South Carolina is going to have to figure out how to move the ball on the ground because they're not explosive enough through the air. 9th worst in the entire country. Helinski has been a pleasant surprise, and it looks like he's going to keep this job. Bentley is out of business, so to speak. So, but still, 99th in passing success rate for the Gamecocks offense. So when you're looking for these upsets, right, aside from turnovers, which they got last week, you need explosiveness. And South Carolina hasn't shown to have that through the air. And it's, again, it's likely that Helinski's operating less than 100% to boot. So in knowing that, right, and knowing the Gamecocks offensive line has been better in run blocking than pass protection, and knowing DC Todd Grantham likes to send pressure, I would envision that he is probably going to do the opposite of the Auburn game plan. And Grantham's probably going to elect to send a heavy dose of heat here, I would think, for at Helinski.
Do you worry that he's not able to do that if Florida's down its top 2 pass rushers?
Sending pressure? I mean, you'd obviously love to get pressure with your front 4, right? And we knew the injuries defensively for Florida last week, that they've been dealing with that injury to their best pass rusher for most of the season. And it certainly is not going to be beneficial here, but this is just a different animal offensively, right? This isn't LSU. This isn't Joe Brady. No, this isn't Joe Burrow. There's no weapons on the outside that are nearly identical to what LSU has. So when you look, though, South Carolina, 69th in the country in adjusted sack rate allowed. So you would obviously love to have your best 2 pass rushers, but I think there's probably still an ability to get some heat on Helinski. I think Grantham has to dial it up knowing he's not 100%. One thing Helinski's done that's, you know, pretty good so far, he's been getting the ball out quick, right? He is pretty accurate so far, although that has struggled and some, you know, declined a little bit against tougher defenses, Missouri to speak of. I believe he only completed 45% of his passes in the Missouri game. So this is a step up in class, although Georgia was extremely, you know, a daunting task last week. But for me, a tough spot. I think the number at 5 is probably good. I don't know if South Carolina is going to be able to do enough for the longevity of this game offensively, but maybe they have the confidence early here, and Florida has a slow start. But I don't really have much on this game in terms of the numbers pretty good. We have two situations where, you know, Florida could come in off a tough loss, potentially a little out of sorts. In Carolina, in South Carolina, let's see, as you alluded to, how do they handle Prosperity?
Going to be an interesting contest because you mentioned Florida still everything to play for, obviously, in the SEC as far as winning the East, knowing what they have ahead of them. And South Carolina would love nothing more than to get one of these key wins, as we talked, as you mentioned, early in the season, how difficult it would be for them to get to six wins and postseason eligibility. Wins in back-to-back weeks against SEC East heavyweights Georgia and Florida would go a long way towards making those postseason aspirations potentially become a reality. When you look at South Carolina, they've actually been very good of late as an underdog. The last 17 times they've been installed as a pup, 12-5 against the number. We'll see if that trend continues this weekend. From the SEC out to Big 12 country, it's Stillwater, Oklahoma, where we'll see an undefeated Baylor team put it that record on the line against Oklahoma State. It's the Cowboys, a 4-point favorite in that contest. Total in this game, 3.5, excuse me, there. Total in this game sits at 66 at Fox Bet. I guess, Payne, the biggest question I have for you as it pertains to Baylor, yes, they're undefeated. Yes, they've shown flashes of brilliance. They've almost let victory slip away against Texas Tech and Iowa State, but they've been able to remain unblemished so far. Are you a buyer of what Matt Rhule is building down there in Waco?
Definitely a buyer of what Matt Rhule is doing, right? No question about that. For this specific game, though, are they potentially... Listen, the number is telling us quite a story here. And there is a battle going on as I speak, right? Back out to four on Oklahoma State. So for me, long term, Matt Rhule's fantastic. He's going to get this program cleaned up, turned around. They're 6-0. Kudos to him. He's building it his way, right? Defensively, with some trench play as well, getting good quarterback play. So long term, this is a home run hire with Matt Rhule. In this game, current form season, they're probably a little overrated. This is a game where if you're looking at a neutral field, Baylor probably is about a 2.5-3 point favorite.
Strong words when you look at the way the Bears have performed. You talk about some of their offensive efficiency. Charlie Brewer has taken the next step in his development. We know there's some major concerns about Oklahoma State on the defensive side of the ball. When you look at the Pokes' failure most games to create turnovers, they've only done that in 3 of the 6 games. And Baylor wants to come at you with balance. But I think, Payne, for me, the more fascinating matchup is on the other side. When we look at Oklahoma State, their calling card has been the offense against a Baylor defense that'll go into this game without their defensive leader and leading tackler. Can Spencer Saunders, after a bye week, kind of get back to basics and create that dynamic run, pass, balance that we've grown accustomed to from Coach Gundy over the years?
Well, I think it's a little different this year, right? And Oklahoma State's offense is a bit weird, right? It's Spencer Saunders running the ball more. Oklahoma State right now, throwing the ball in 37.5% of snaps. It's like 14% lower than last year. It's 14% lower than Mason Rudolph's last season there. Credit to Sean Gleason, the new Cowboys OC. He's kind of changed his offense to complement the pieces that he has. And overall, if you look at the efficiency, there hasn't been a ton of drop-off, right? Like Oklahoma State's offense finished 7th last season. They're 8th right now. But it does look different. There's been lots of running from Spencer Saunders. 505 yards on the ground. Even more impressive to me is what he's doing on designed runs. Almost 5 yards a carry. He's been big. He's been elusive. He's broken 29 tackles so far this season. So he's been that added element, the X factor to the offense, providing basically another piece, right? Because most of the time you're playing 10 on 11 when you have a mobile quarterback. It presents a little bit tougher task for defenses. But I think in this game, Saunders is going to have to be a threat with his arm a little bit, because part of that improvement for Baylor that I talked about overall as a team, it's because their defense, their front 7, they've been more physical. The production has been outstanding. They are literally stomping out opposing ground games. 28% of runs Baylor has stopped at or behind the line of scrimmage. That's 8th best in the country. on standard downs or passing. Like, it just, it doesn't matter. They've been fantastic stopping the run. They've also gotten to opposing quarterbacks. Doesn't matter what down or distance it is. So for me, like, this matchup, Todd, it's good on good. It's Chuba Hubbard. It's Spencer Saunders' legs against a really good Baylor front seven that's only allowed 34% of runs to grade successful. I think whoever wins that battle likely wins this side of the ball. But again, the betting market is certainly saying the Cowboys show up here in a big way. Intrigued to see what Baylor is going to be able to do offensively, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's a unit that I watch, and I'm not wowed by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, I've seen them perform against Iowa State. They built a commanding 21-0 lead, did everything in their power to try and give that away, needed to hold on for dear life last weekend against Texas Tech, a game where they were double-digit favorites. And we look at some of their playmakers offensively and what they have in Denzel Mims and Tyquan Thornton. I'm going to be very curious because this Oklahoma State defense, when I've watched them, I wasn't impressed by anything I saw in Lubbock, but it seems that every year from Coach Gundy, you get one clunker within the conference, and it doesn't matter if it's at home. It doesn't matter if it's on the road. It's an inexplicable data point that you almost just want to kind of throw out of the mix. So we'll see what we have here. I have to imagine this team is refocused, recentered, coming off of the bye to try and get things ready to go in this particular spot. One thing I wanted to ask you, though, Payne, and I mean, I know we don't get into players a ton, and you try and figure out what it means from a greater scheme. I mean, Clay Johnston is 58 tackles, was 28 more than any other player on the Baylor roster, averaging just less than 10 tackles per game. And some of the quotes were pretty outspoken. Hey, we're not going to replace his productivity. And I think back to Remember the Titans. You don't try and replace a Gary Bertier. And from this Baylor team, you think it just ends up being everybody has to step their game up when you go into hostile territory and hope, hey, we're going to win the game at the point of contact, and that's how we're going to try and choke out the run, something they've been so successful at all season?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I mean, that's been the Baylor defensive calling card. Been a great front seven. It's certainly a massive loss there, especially, again, the style of offense you're going against in Oklahoma State with Chuba Howard and Spencer Saunders, who want to do it on the ground. I think the other element here when we look at Baylor is, what are they going to do offensively? You mentioned at the top, Oklahoma State's defense, that you weren't overly impressed with them. For me, like, they're not good. They're not elite. But I think we're going to find out if they've made strides, if they've made some improvements. Because metrically speaking, both Baylor's offense and Oklahoma State's defense have improved pretty significantly, right? I think Charlie Brewer has been fantastic. And so right now Baylor's offense has gone from 39th in overall offensive efficiency to 22nd, despite losing an NFL weapon like Jalen Hurd. Brewer's hitting big throws, top 20 in the country in impact passes, 76% adjusted completion percentage. So he's showing some down to down, consistency as a passer there. Oklahoma State's defense, though, I think has improved. And it's just, again, like, they're not elite. They've made strides. And I think that's the one thing that people laugh and bust their balls about a little bit. It's the kind of improvement you're looking for. Just go from being really bad to average. And so right now, Oklahoma State's defense, despite playing in the Big 12, and I think we had a slew of question marks coming into the season about their defensive line. They were like picking up transfers from schools that Power 5 teams shouldn't be picking up transfers from to fill these holes in at defensive line. But right now, Oklahoma State, 49th in defensive efficiency. They've done significantly better, limiting big plays. 117th last year in explosive play defense, 65th this season. So I think, you know, obviously Baylor is going to move the ball here, and they're going to do it probably pretty efficiently, right? Top 35 in both passing and rushing success rate. You combine that with that efficiency with their explosiveness, which is 13th. And right now, this is going to shock some people, Baylor's got the 8th most efficient offense top to bottom in all of college football. So, you know, the way Oklahoma State's defense is going to compete here is trying to find a way to get pressure on Brewer, create some negative plays on early downs. They haven't been doing that very well, but Baylor's offensive line still has some issues. I know Matt Rhule's trying to get that figured out. He wants some big uglies up front. They're 84th in stuff rate, so they've allowed defenses to create some havoc, get in the backfield. So, you know, I think, again, relative is always a key word that I like to use here. If Oklahoma State can hold Baylor to like 31, they probably have a very good chance. And you look at the three offenses that Oklahoma State's faced defensively, that are inside the top 40 in offensive efficiency. They've given up an average of 39 points. They've lost two of those three matchups. So the defense, if you can hold Baylor to 31 or 33 or even maybe even 34, you have a shot in this game for sure.
Always a major question mark when you talk Oklahoma State football, what the defense is going to give you. You have to imagine the offense will bounce back after they were forced to play from behind the last time we saw them going into the bye in Lubbock against Texas Tech. So if we had questions defensively about Oklahoma State, Payne, I don't think we have questions defensively about these two teams. And that, of course, is the Big Ten game in prime time where Penn State welcomes in the Michigan Wolverines. Penn State, a 9-point favorite, total in the game 45.5 at FoxBet. And we look at the last two meetings. Clearly, we've seen blowouts of epic proportions. Last season, Michigan winning 42-7 at home, returning the favor from a 42-13 thrashing they took at the hands of Penn State in Happy Valley the last time the series was played here. We know about Jim Harbaugh, 1-6 against ranked teams on the road over his five seasons as Michigan's coach. But I guess when we talk this game, we have to start with the defense, and it feels like Penn State's stop unit is a logical place to begin the discussion.
One of the best in college football, right? Right now, you're looking at a Penn State defense that is top five in success rate, passing success rate, rushing success rate. But they are just 10th in overall schedule-adjusted efficiency, and it's because they really haven't played a pulse on offense, right? You think Buffalo, Pittsburgh, Iowa, Maryland. I mean, none of those offenses really register as being elite. Maryland and Iowa are just above average. The one offense that they've faced that is currently top 25 in efficiency is Purdue, but Penn State faced them without their starting quarterback and their starting wide receiver. So no Sindelar, no more. And I think that's really what, and I'm not saying Michigan's going to present some, you know, tough task offensively here, because I'm not sure they are. That's where this game's going to really come down to. Can Shea Patterson act like a competent quarterback? He's leading a Michigan offense right now that's 79th in success rate. He is 66th in passing success rate. So he hasn't really done much. And you look last week against Illinois, you were hoping for like this full game effort, and the offense just kind of fell asleep. They started off very good in that game. They got out to this big lead against Illinois and then just fell asleep at the wheel for some reason. Not really sure what happened there. You look at the first quarter, came out like with their hair on fire, 68% success rate in the first quarter for Michigan's offense, followed it up with a 65% success rate in the second quarter. Whether there was no adjustments or they just thought the game was over and they were looking ahead to Penn State, they almost lost that game. And Shea Patterson wasn't very good in the second half, 27% success rate in the third quarter. But Shea Patterson is going to have to be efficient throwing the ball here. The offensive line for Michigan is going to have to continue to be more effective in the ground game. We talked a couple weeks back leading up to the Iowa game where they had shifted some things back to what they were doing offensively with their zone running scheme. And so the ground game has been much better. Last week we saw Haskins the freshman, Zach Charbonnet, much better. Both of them had over a 50% success rate running the ball. So that's going to have to be the key here. I think the other thing is when we look at Penn State, this is a good test for them defensively. I don't think they're going to have like struggles here, but they really haven't faced many competent offenses. So big test here for Shea Patterson, big test here for the Penn State defense. I think we'll have a lot of answers here to what these two teams are, and God forbid Michigan gets blown out. What is the national narrative regarding Harbaugh and his job security here?
Well, if you believe the Michigan offensive players, tight end Nick Eubanks coming out this week saying our defense has their identity, which obviously everybody with a pulse understands as it pertains to Michigan. He says our offense is getting our identity as well. We found a groove of it. We believe it's coming together. You know, the last time I heard this, Payne, it was going into the Iowa game after they had that 52-0 win against Rutgers. They mustered a grand total of 10 points, and you, myself, and all of our loyal listeners had a hold on for dear life watching a football game that may have set the sport back 50 years. On the other side of the ball, Michigan matched up against Penn State's offense. And admittedly so, I've really struggled in my assessment of Penn State because of what they bring to the table offensively. I don't think that they were extremely impressive with their win in Iowa City last weekend. My ticket on Iowa plus the points notwithstanding. When you look at the way that Penn State wants to go out there and approach with Clifford under center, knowing KJ Hamler is their playmaker or a ground game that can be hit or miss, do you think Michigan can do enough defensively to force Penn State out of its comfort zone on the road?
That was a big 2-point miss last week.
Yeah, it was a little bit costly.
And what's the bigger kick in the nuts is after the initial dummy there on Penn State, there was like 3 spots that got the 5. And I'm like sitting there waiting. I'm like, man, we might get to 6 here. And it went to 4.5 and we took 4.5. So that was a big 2-point miss. Let's be honest, though. Penn State was pretty lucky to win last week, right? The 2 turnovers led to 10 points. And then holding Iowa to like 3s instead of 7s is why I think PSU won at Kinnick. Sean Clifford and the Penn State offense was pretty terrible last week. 3.8 yards per play. Clifford had a 19% success rate throwing the ball on passing down. So to me, unheard of to win on the road in 2019 doing that, but PSU did. Clifford averaged 3.8 yards per pass attempt as well. There was zero explosiveness from the PSU offense last week. But Penn State did do a pretty good job running the ball, right? The O-line that we've kind of had question marks for years about, and they're still like 78th in adjusted line yards this season. They dominated the trenches last week. Penn State had a rushing success rate 9% above the national average against a defense significantly better than average. So it was like that combination of Noah Cain and Clifford on both designed runs and scrambles. I think those two guys were the difference in the game, sustaining a couple of those drives, converting green zone trips into points. I do believe Penn State's offense is probably going to look a little better this week at home, right? And to me, I know you have some questions, and obviously I still do offensively as well, but I think Sean Clifford overall has been a pleasant surprise, right? You look, to me, Clifford's been efficient. There's been some explosiveness to the offense. He's taken care of the football. It's really rare to have that combination like Penn State has right now. And you look across the board, 17th in passing success rate, 20th in explosive passing. And to my point of Clifford kind of taking care of the ball, 2 passes have graded interceptable on 159 attempts. So he's valuing the football while he's taking shots down the field, which is a nice combination. Michigan's defense, I think we kind of know what they are, but my mind says, and again, you watch these games closer than I do, I don't believe they're the third best in the country like the metrics suggest, right?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, they're a bit of a paper tiger in that regard. By no means am I like saying they're bad, right? This is like a relative thing. I'm not sure Don Brown just has an elite defense this year. And if you look, the 6 offenses that Michigan's faced, they have a combined average efficiency ranking of 70th. If you remove Wisconsin from the equation, that number goes to 80th. So the one offense that Michigan has faced with a pulse, also on the road, put up 6.7 yards per play, a yard better than the national average. The one offense that Michigan has faced, again, with a pulse, they allowed a 49% success rate, which is 7% greater than the national average. So this is a really tough test and a really big test for Michigan's defense. Let's see what they truly are, because I don't believe they're the third best defense in college football.
No, I'm right there with you. Now, one thing I will say about that Wisconsin game is Wisconsin did some things that I'm not quite sure Penn State can actually do. Correct. And when I say that, what I mean is going out there, just bullying them at the point of contact and using an explosive offensive line to create holes for Jonathan Taylor, as he had one of his biggest games on a high-profile stage. Penn State, I think, has to be a little bit more creative. And when you look at this Michigan defense, they don't have the same athletes. There's not the playmakers of a Chase Winovich or a Devin Bush that we've grown accustomed to, at least in my opinion, having watched them multiple times. And I'm very curious to see if James Franklin in Penn State looks to imply a lot of shallow crossing routes that Michigan just hasn't been able to make adjustments to, whether it's Iowa. Ohio State's going to do that to a lot of people, and people look at that game last year. But even Iowa, if they had stuck to that plan, all it takes is getting an athlete running these linebackers into one another under these soft man coverage, and you can have all sorts of big play potential. So I'm very curious to see how Penn State elects to attack this Michigan defense.
And KJ Hamler is probably the guy you're going to employ on those crossing routes against linebackers, and he is going to exploit them just like he did a week ago against Iowa's linebackers. That was the more frustrating thing last week, watching a Iowa linebacker attempt to cover KJ Hamler in space, in the slot. And of course he couldn't on 3rd and 7, and Hamler makes that ridiculous play, diving across the goal line for a touchdown. But, you know, basically I was out there covering him.
Yeah, I was going to say it'd basically be like you trying to cover me in the turkey bowl. I'm feasting all day.
Oh, God.
I mean, we're talking Torrey Holt numbers for me on the greatest show on turf I'm putting up if you're defending me.
Oh, jeez. Oh, jeez. I'm not buying it. But yeah, to your point, though, you know, Michigan has immensely, you know, struggled immensely with crossing routes. Iowa, to your point, was executing them pretty well. It's why I thought their receiving core looked better than I think the national media think they are. Or the national narrative is Iowa, I don't think, has as good as a receiving core as Penn State, obviously, but even they had success on those crossing routes. Just the linebackers, the style of play, just can't keep up with wide receivers. And you can't do it. In 2019, you aren't going to be able to cover wide receivers with linebackers. So that is one thing to watch offensively, is see if Clifford's able to execute on those crossing routes. And if he is, I think Penn State's offense is probably going to be able to make enough plays to win this game.
Last thing on this particular game, Payne, want to get in discussion of the number. We saw it open over a touchdown, 7.5, more or less the consensus. It's been bet up, still in the dead zone. Haven't seen a 10 pop, which I imagine create an appetite for the underdog. Do you feel it's fair or foul with where most books have elected to hang this particular point spread?
I thought 7.5 was pretty telling, coming above the key. And certainly when you look at the Wisconsin game, you know, you were dealing with what in that game, a 3.5? I don't think anyone has Penn State against Wisconsin on a neutral 6 points better. So through some key numbers in there as well. So is the number currently a little inflated? Yes, but it was also pretty telling. And then just matchup wise, this game has a component to it where it could snowball, knowing how inefficient Michigan's offense has been, knowing that Shea Patterson, although he's been a little bit better, his lack of pocket awareness has created a lot of situations where he hasn't been able to hold on to the football. So you start having those situations where you have to become extremely reliant on Shea Patterson to make plays, whether it's with his legs or his arms playing catch up. You could have a snowball effect for sure.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's always interesting, and I know a lot of people typically ask us, why do you guys tend to gravitate towards first half totals? And I think the biggest thing always becomes, hey, look, teams can stay on their game script. They don't have to throw caution to the wind over the first 30 minutes unless things get really out of sync. Whereas the second half, you mentioned it, especially at the college football ranks, the last thing you want is an inefficient offense having to play from behind, chucking the ball over the yard, creating short fields, and heaven help you, special teams or defensive touchdowns. So can understand exactly where you're going with that. Five games down in the books, we still have other business to attend to, and our best bet brought to you courtesy of Fox Bet. The biggest name in sports is now the hottest name in sports betting and one of the fastest growing betting apps out there. Whatever sports you like betting, Fox Bet has you covered. You can download the app to your smartphone from anywhere and place wagers on dozens of sports and events with the easy to use app, only available in New Jersey and Pennsylvania for real money wagering. Fox Bet, make the call and download the app today. Payne, where do we think we find opportunity as far as a best investment is concerned?
All right, let's go with, since the theme of this show is Pac-12 football, Todd, I know you love that.
I am so proud of how far you've come, Payne. I really thought that once the Pac-12 became the only power conference with no teams that were undefeated, you were going to say, nope, we're not talking about Pac-12 games. And then you go out there and you totally surprise me, proposing two Pac-12 games making today's podcast. It warms my heart.
You had an opportunity there for a Dumb and Dumb reference there.
I know. I was going to go, do you know what you've done?
Totally redeemed myself.
I was going to butcher it. Whether the Hawaiian Tropic line or the scooter line, my brain is not firing on all cylinders.
It was just you totally redeemed yourself. That was it. So, but when we talk about the Pac-12 and the best bet here, it's two teams that are not soft. It's two teams that are physical, two teams that like to run the ball. My kind of game. Let's go with 360 first half under 24.5 between Arizona State and Utah. First half under. And again, weather would just be a bonus, but right now they're calling for about a 54% chance of rain, 15-mile-per-hour steady winds. Two teams that want to establish the ground game, two physical teams, two teams defensively that have shown an ability to stop the ground game. So this just kind of feels like a grinder, despite two teams playing in the soft Pac-12. So like the first half under in Arizona State, Utah, 24.5, that is across the board available. Now, again, if you're listening to this, you know, 2 hours before kickoff, that's probably not going to be the number. So
do you want to save people the trouble and say that we give it out at 24.5? No, we don't like you going under 21.5 on game day.
Listen, so, I mean, is 24 still good. Yes. Does that half point effectively create potentially another possession? Yes. We're going to grade it at 24.5 because that's the only number that's out there right now. But if you know you are listening on Saturday and you can still get a 24, probably still worth some money, but we'll grade it at 24.5. So 360, Arizona State, Utah, first half, under 24, plus a hook.
And full disclosure here, we debated going to the depths of college football for the best bet. We kicked around Conference USA.
Yeah.
We kicked around the American Athletic. So we were not about to leave any stone unturned. Although, Payne, the more I think about it, and this is a completely random tangent, I don't know if we've ever gone to the Sun Belt for a best bet on this podcast.
It's tough to back the likes of the two Florida coaches there. Butch? And who's your guy there at FAU?
Actually, I always forget his name. Hold on. I take that back. And this is how bad my memory is. We have gone to the Sun Belt, Coastal Carolina, earlier this season.
That's right. You're all right.
So we've officially gone everywhere.
So, yeah, to my point there. Jeez, I can't not believe I forgot Lane Kiffin's name. Lane and Butch, I don't know what's going on with them, but they're enjoying South Florida. They are enjoying the bars of South Florida and the lovely women of South Florida. Football product hasn't been as good as advertised for either. So that's probably why we haven't really gone to the Sun
Belt. It's all about quality of life, my friend. Two things that are one thing that you and I know nothing about as it pertains to football season.
Oh, it's brutal. I got to tell you, I felt like a normal human. I slept Monday night. I slept 7.5 hours. Last night, I got about 5.5. That's a lot for me. So I did. I felt good about being a new normal human there. Holidays are coming up. Maybe think about a little drinking. Who knows? We'll see how that goes. But yes, Coastal Carolina, your memory is bad. We did win against, was it Kansas?
The Kansas Jayhawks.
All right, we're rambling now. Under first half, 24.5 Arizona State, Utah. Let's get the hell out of here.
All right. As always, you can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. You can follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. You can follow me there as well at Todd Furman. Thanks to all the hard work, Payne, that you put in to try and break down two Pac-12 games. I know it goes against everything you stand for. Best bet, Utah, Arizona State.
I'm also
first half under.
Bust your balls before we get out of here.
I think my signal's starting to break up.
Yep.
Break up. I can't really hear what you're saying.
You had a Titanic moment here. We did not break down, and people are going to think this one's on me. I shortchanged him. We did not break down the Florida offense, and we're not going to go back and do it now, but we did not, I don't believe.
We did not. We mentioned Kyle Trask in passing, but we did not get a full-blown in-depth analysis.
People are going to come at your neck. Direct it towards Todd. He's going with your old age, and I hate to joke about this, but we do have to start checking for Alzheimer's.
Oh, it's bad. It's bad, man. This is the middle of the season where you get into the dog days of preparation. And you know what the worst part is? I had an extensive section of my notes to try and talk about that side of the ball.
We covered them in great detail. I mean, I think we've talked Florida football every week here now.
I'm going to go back. I got to look at the teams we've talked about a decent amount. I feel like the two teams that are probably going to make the college football playoff that I don't think we've talked about in any great detail in the podcast recently, Alabama. And we may not get to Clemson until they play the ACC championship.
That's very, very possible. Yeah, you, again, restricted me for the second week in a row talking FSU football.
All right, we'll find a way to get FSU football in there because everyone will be thrilled to know when they're fighting to go 6-6 and go to the Independence Bowl how excited you are about their postseason.
All right, let's
go. All right, on that note, all kidding aside, thanks to all of you, our loyal listeners out there who tune in for every single Bet the Board podcast, not only for the college football, but also the two-time weekly installment of the National Football League. Come Saturday afternoon in Salt Lake City, we'll see you at the window.